It's time for You Talking to Me with your host, Big JD.
That's right, I'm your host, Big JD. You're listening to You Talking to Me on CJAM. Whether you're familiar with Windsor Rockers Tees or not, they're a driving force in Canadian rock history, and they performed internationally, achieved gold record status, and were nominated for a number of Junos. This late 70s, early 80s band will always be an important piece of Canada's rock and roll past, and here to talk about the past, present, and the future is Tees guitarist Mark Braddock and Tees drummer Mike Kozak. Welcome to the show.
Good to see you.
Hello, Big JD.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's great to have you on
we
here.
We don't get asked a lot anymore. Correction, we never get asked anymore.
Well, before we get into what you guys did, let's talk a little bit about how you did it and how you got started. So did you guys come from musical families at all or anything like that? Or
wow. You can answer that, Coase?
Not particularly. My dad played a little trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
He loved music.
So you played trumpet in Tees then?
Yeah, I played a little horn. Played a little bebop.
Man.
My dad, he had a great taste in music. He remember, mm-hmm. You remember coming over to my house
your
when I was a kid.
Your dad was fabulous.
He had he had stuff that was cool. He had Miles Davis around the house,
right.
And things like that, and Ray Charles, and he went all the way to Broadway show tunes, which brought him into question in many levels. But
is that the kind of stuff that you kind of grew up on, some of that music?
Well, it was just around, right?
And
then, of course, you develop your own taste when you're a kid.
Sure.
And so that led me to the Beatles. And, my cousin's fellow named Jack Scott, who's quite a local legend.
Oh, he's a cousin. Okay.
Yeah, he's
I was just talking about
mine.
Him with Bob Steele yesterday, actually.
Okay, yeah. He's a first cousin of mine.
Yep.
And he was from an early age, I was aware of his success and stuff like that. So even having that around, that was sort of an influence on me.
And wow. Did you come from a musical family, Marco?
My dad, as soon as I picked up guitar, he said, I'm leaving.
He was leaving, or he said, you're leaving?
He left, man. He says, you'll never amount to nothing. You're going to pick up this guitar, and what are you going to do with it? You should be a pawn man, that's what he said. And look what happened, man. But no, I didn't get much support from my mother was, saying play the guitar and do that. I started playing guitar, I guess, when I was about 9 years old. Wow, that's a long time ago.
And where did you get that guitar from?
Wow, I got that guitar from a grocery store, actually. My mother had food stamps.
Okay.
My dad was kind of tight, and he would never shell out the money for anything.
Loblaws?
Loblaws, man.
Loblaws?
Well, people don't remember Loblaws, because that's probably like
Lucky Green Stamps.
Just post-depression or something, you know?
Lucky Green Stamps.
Well, it's the Loblaws Corporation that still owns Zayers and Superstore.
If I had to track it back how I started to play guitar, I'd have to thank Loblaws for that.
And they're still providing Marco with his equipment.
That's right. A little Stella guitar, right?
Guitar by Loblaws.
Remember Stella guitars? No, I don't see.
Not really.
JD.
Just a little bit before my time.
You gotta get out more,
not,
JD.
Not much.
You gotta get out, man. Anyway.
My first guitar was a Gibson.
Wow.
Oh, come on.
No,
really?
It wasn't. No.
That's terrible.
Well, mine was a Stella. And then I took guitar lessons for 2 weeks, and I got jumped. And they stole my guitar.
Oh, yeah?
And that was it.
Really?
So I played by ear ever since. You didn't know that, Coase?
No.
That's true.
You got jumped?
The old man Ciccone there was teaching me on the corner of Victoria and Wyandotte.
Mm-hmm.
And
I remember that place.
Home halfway between.
I remember the place.
Yeah. Was it like
I
had a turrets on it and stuff?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd actually been in there, but I just remember the place when I was a kid.
Had a drawbridge. It was like a moat,
And that I don't remember.
There was horses. There was no vehicles at the time.
They took your guitar from you?
Yeah, they stole my guitar. They beat three guys, jumped me, and stole my guitar. And then I told my mother I'm never going back to guitar lessons again, and then I played by ear ever since, which kind of sucks, because I could have probably achieved more if I could read music. But, c'est la vie.
I don't know if you turn out the same, though, going by the book.
Well, it would be better.
You know what I mean?
I guess,
I suppose.
If you're natural at playing guitar, then that's a good thing. But if you read, at least you could, extend that into a life of a studio musician.
Yeah, sure. I guess
or teaching people. But when you just play by ear, what do, man? You go for the big stuff, and if it don't happen, I don't know, you get a job in a pawn shop.
Oh, you end up, you end up on TV, I guess. Right?
Yeah. Hey!
You become a pawn master.
Bada bing!
What about your first kid, or how'd you get started playing, actually?
Well, just buddies in high school, right?
Yep.
Kind of couple of those guys played, and you know how it works. You know, a few friends play, and you go watch them, and you kind of get the bug, and then local bands, you go see the old, I remember the Lonely Nights from back in the day, those bands, stuff like that, the Power and the Glory.
Forget Kozak. Listen to this story. Forget what Kozak's saying.
Oh, what do you got?
I was the last guy in the band.
Okay. Well, wait, are we talking about Ontario,
It was Ontario, because that's pre-Tees.
Pre-Tees band,
so
Ontario.
So I'm the last guy in the band. There's Kozak, there's Danner, and there's Chuck Pleiss.
Inside joke.
Price. Okay. and you had somebody else, right? I can't remember his name. And when I showed up, this guy didn't work out. So, I don't know. I showed up at the music store one day at LRC. I think Brian picked me out of a crowd. Says, you might do. And they brought me to rehearsal, and Kozak refused to play with me. Let's make that a fact. Said, the guy's got really bad hair. First sent him to a barber. That's what Kozak said. Can you believe that?
You had hair like the caveman?
That's right, like the guy in Kansas.
You had just gigantic hair.
But you guys weren't in Kansas anymore.
I went to a high school that had like 1,300 people, and I had the only hair that didn't fit in the graduate picture. I'm serious, man.
His hair was super long. And you wore these little short shirts.
That's right. Those belly shirts.
Oh, yeah, those half shirts, yeah.
You had a thing with my belly shirts, too. You didn't like that.
Were they mesh?
An attractive combo.
The mesh half shirts. So Ontario got signed, though, in 1974. What?
Oh, boy.
And then how'd that lead into Tees? Was it long after?
Well, actually, it was the same band, right? Same guys. We called it Ontario because Brian had a band originally called Ontario.
Okay.
That was a three-piece band and kind of locally popular. And so when we got together with him, we thought, well, we'll just kind of use that name because it had a little bit of cachet in the area. So we did that, but then we had to change it because it just wasn't a good name.
Hard to trademark Ontario when there's a governor, it's hard to trademark that name.
We played locally, and a fellow from Toronto who was a music wholesaler who had some connections with the old Mel Shaw people.
Exactly truthful, I might say. He said he was the manager for a band called the Stampeders at the time.
I don't remember that.
The Stampeders.
Yes, he did. Well, he said he was a
Wild
manager.
Eyes. Didn't they do Excuse Wild me. Eyes?
That's right, mm-hmm. right. Sweet City Woman.
Sweet City Woman.
Yeah. There's another one, too, that was a
They were a big Canadian act at the time, actually.
Well, yeah, but anyway, song, Manitou. That was a great song.
He presented our stuff to this guy in Toronto, this Mel Shaw guy, and it kind of just took off from there. He invited us up to do what we thought was a demo, which ended up being our first record.
Okay.
Which was none of us outside Brian and experience in the studio, I think, right?
I think we cut that record, in about 16 hours?
16 hours. And we thought, well, that's a demo. And then next thing you know, it's...
And that's the record that launched and us that in
was,
Japan.
Was that under Ontario, though, when that
no,
started?
No,
you
that
you
was
changed
right
the name
transition.
Already?
Okay, the record changed the name.
All right.
But the funny thing about that was you ended up getting rid of that manager. And when we tried to get rid... That was a great story about meeting the Stones. When we were getting rid of the manager and we were practically homeless and we were driving in a subway and remember that? And then we were going to see these new guys that we didn't even know and they were saying, we can't see you right now. We're really busy. And we're saying, well, you know, I know you're really busy, but we're really hungry and we have no clothes and we have this bum manager and, you know, we really got to talk about this because he's screwing you and he's screwing us.
He wasn't, though. He wasn't, to be honest.
Well, he kind of was.
And that was the guy you're talking about. Then you guys changed management eventually and signed to a major label.
This was in the transition period, right? Right, the new guys had signed us away from the other company, but they retained our manager. Right.
Oh, okay.
But at some point, he had to sell a piece of us for money because we needed cash flow.
So during the transition, we were stuck in Toronto, and we were trying to voice our complaints to our new management people, and that's where we were calling.
That's right. So they call us in. You know, we take this. They said, "Okay, we'll meet you." You know, because we cried enough. And they said, we'll meet you at a place called the Windsor Arms Hotel. That's what it was, right?
Yeah.
So we walk into this place, and we've never seen a place like this in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
It had a flautist and a harpist in the foyer.
Yeah.
Right? And we just thought, wow, this is unbelievable.
And everybody.
And we walked into this room, and here was these people that we didn't know that we were going to go meet, and they were sitting with the Rolling Stones. So obviously we knew at that point that we were in the right hands. And the rest was history.
All right. Well, we have some Tees here that we're going to play, and this is... the song On the Loose.
Bam.
Can you tell us anything special about it or anything like that? Or?
It's a ripper, man.
That was our first album on Aquarius, right?
Shreds paint off walls.
And this is it.
Yeah.
In the radio studios, the technicians, the entertainers, the commentators, the administrative personnel daily unite their efforts in the creation of programs to please and entertain a vast radio public.
We awaken to it in the morning, we set our clocks by it, we dress according to the weather reports. We listen to radio for news, for entertainment. It keeps us informed every minute of every day. That's radio for you, close to every member of the family. From its very birth, radio has been a public servant. It will continue its dedicated service throughout the years to come.
You're tuned to CJ 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
All right, we're back. I'm with Mark Braddock and Mike Kozak from the rock band Tease. I want to ask you guys what you felt your biggest accomplishments were with the band.
Biggest accomplishments? Well, probably...
Well,
I'd say you guys did a lot of
the
stuff.
The room goes silent.
Japan. Well, Japan was probably, you know, that was unusual at the time for a Canadian band, especially of our status. We weren't a very big band. We never got to be a very big band. But even at the time... nobody else from Canada was making it over there, unless you're maybe a BTO, maybe someone like that. But all the other bands, remember, were all.
I think what we prided ourselves in was being an opening act. We used to love that. We used to love bands like Jay Giles and Foghat.
You guys played with a lot of big bands.
Yeah,
really. Kiss too, and
Aerosmith, Toto,
Cheap Trick.
Yeah. Meatloaf.
Meatloaf, Triumph, Aerosmith, or we said that, I don't know.
So then the live Tour Japan album, what prompted you guys to release a live album, and especially from Japan and maybe not like, you know, North America or Canada or something like that?
Because it was free.
Okay.
Yeah, because the Japanese paid for it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
We were much farther ahead career-wise in Japan than we were anywhere else.
Sure.
Well, we were only in Canada.
Well, that
at the time.
Happens a lot. Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted to get something out. They just couldn't get enough product. So they recorded it, and then the tapes were offered to the Canadian company, and so they said, "Well, we'll put it out too." It was weird because we'd only had two records out at the time, so it wasn't much to pull.
And while we were there, we had shot a 70mm. Probably a 3-4 hour feature film, right?
How do you know?
Oh yeah,
millimeters.
Well, you guys shot that. Where is that? Where is that?
We can't find it. That's interesting.
Well,
we shot it,
and
they had plans of releasing it at the time.
Wow.
As a feature film, I guess, because it was that.
I think it was cut.
But Cheap Trick came out with their Live at the Budokan.
Yeah.
So they kind of beat us to the punch at the time. It was always happening at the same time.
I think the Japanese company actually cut it into a TV special and put it out in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
We saw the footage here. I remember we went to a film studio and watched it, and it just wasn't very... The sound was really bad on the film, I remember.
I can't recall.
Right? And so it would have been expensive, I think, to fix that. And so, but in the meantime, it got lost.
Well, what happened is once we didn't use it, we started cutting it up for commercials when we would go on tour. So they'd take some live footage out of here, live footage out of there.
Yeah.
It was bouncing around between probably CBC studios at the time. And eventually, I don't know what happened to it.
Were they following you around and stuff too, and everything, and a lot of footage of just you guys doing, or was it all live type?
Oh, it was live. I think there was a little bit.
Well,
I think there was a little backstage stuff. I think.
There was stuff in the hotel.
We saw it only once.
And there was a lot of footage of the kids and stuff. Remember how conservative kids, they were, and they all had their uniforms on. And
kids lined up outside the hall and stuff like that.
Was crazy.
But it's disappeared, and we've been looking, and we've really tried hard because it'd be fun to see for us. I don't think anybody else, but
yeah, because I'm doing a TV show now. I had a wish list when I was doing Pawnathon, and they said to me, I said, "Well, what do you wish for?" And I said, "Well, I wish I could find some of that Tease footage, because we had also did another. There was no video back then; it was just pre-video. So we had did a of the first album. They had paid for that 8-song
that was a promotional
thing that we
thing,
did,
yeah.
And I'd love to see that. That was great.
That was done in a Montreal studio.
Yeah.
We were lip syncing, and it was just
it was kind of a video, but it was done of the whole album.
Mm-hmm.
And it was awesome, man. But that's gone too.
Yeah, that's missing
too. I know that there was the old record company at the time in Montreal had had a flood, and the guy that was in charge of our stuff has
wasn't
died.
Terry Flood, was it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. There you go, Terry's
that
Flood.
Fishy. A foreboding name.
So we fast forward and eventually Tease's demise.
Wow,
happens.
Yeah,
yeah. That was tough for me. That was tough for me.
Yeah, especially since it was your fault.
Wow.
Oh, you were at fault for that?
I was at fault for that. Well, no, maybe.
No, yeah, I'm just saying that.
Who was at fault for that, Kozak?
What?
Who was at fault for the demise of Tease? What the heck happened, man?
I think the lack of success. Cash flow.
Oh, we know what happened. I'm not allowed to talk about that. There's certain individuals that worked on our demise on purpose, I think. You know, wow, I sound like I'm kind of paranoid now or something.
You sound like Jesse Ventura.
Who is that guy behind you there?
Oh, I don't know, man. I hope it's not that guy that ruined my career back in 1986.
I think what ultimately ended it, Brian had enough. Just had enough. And he just was just, it's hard to put together. We were playing opening shows and getting great reviews and just doing great. You know, things were going good on that end. But it didn't translate into money because that's the business. You work, work. You got to work forever, right? To work your way.
You're paying somebody. For everything that you guys do.
You got to work your way up, and then all of a sudden it all comes together at some point. Yep. We were just on our way up. We'd never gotten close, and it was...
I have a different view. I think we just wimped out.
We did quit in the end.
Somebody started, I don't know.
You can blame, you know, over the years you hear, well, bad management, blah, blah, blah. But first things first, you got to keep your band together, right?
Yeah,
we did.
Sure.
That's what we didn't do. And that's your fault.
Well, my fault.
Due to the nature of a 30-minute show, we'll move along and fast forward again to... Today,
Pawnathon Canada.
That's right. You are a pawn master on History Television's Pawnathon Canada. You're a superstar again.
Wow.
And I know the show's doing well. Tell us how you got involved in that, and also Mike's involved in that the recording that you guys are doing again
superstar,
now.
Superstar, he called me. Mike, did you hear that?
I know.
Bam.
I've almost felt
how did that start? That's crazy, because it was all a leap of faith. I got a phone call. They were doing a nationwide television or a telephone search, I guess, of all the pawnbrokers in Canada, and I think I was just filling a void of something they were looking for, because the other four people that I'm working with are, they're like sharks, man. They're just so good at what they do, you know, and they've been doing it their whole lives. And one guy, Douglas, he's on the Antiques Roadshow, and Howard owns the biggest pawn shop in Canada, and I think they needed something a little more. What were they looking for, Coles?
They were looking for earthy people. They were looking for a man of the people. They were looking for something real, something they could hold on to.
They called me on a telephone. They asked me a couple stories. They says, tell me some of your wild stories about the pawn shop. I told them a couple stories. They says, wow, you sound like a whack job. I says, perfect. They says, can we come down and tape you? And I said, sure, come on down and tape me. I still didn't know who they were. So they came down and taped me. I did this little shtick or whatever I did with my guitar. Took about 3-4 months. Still didn't know who these people were. Finally, they called me and they said, listen, we're Shaw Communications and we own History Television and we want you to be on this national show. And it, like, blew me away. Because probably for the first time in my life, I was really thinking about forgetting about everything, right? And just working in the pawn shop. And we be, you know, and you get older and turn 50 years old and... And I don't know, man. It's just
pretty incredible. It's pretty incredible.
I'm sitting on the farm looking at the stars in a rocking chair contemplating retirement and where my first pension check's going to come from, and I get a phone call. Yeah. So it's like you work your whole life at something, and you finally contemplate give up the dream, and then someone calls you.
That's how it happens when you least expect it or you're not looking for something.
Isn't that crazy?
That's when it comes.
That's exactly what happens.
It's amazing. He's as passionate a musician as I've ever known. He's the last guy to quit. He is. He really is. And that was kind of, you know, that's kind of going away. But then the one thing, then the pawn thing, used to burn at him. Yeah. He wanted to get out of there. He used to be...
say something, which was very cool about me. But I was the only... But the television thing...
Aren't so cool either.
The television thing used to say, I don't know, you're the best television show not on TV.
Yeah. That's right. I can go into the store and just watch him.
Yeah.
I used to go... You ever go in the store? You stand against the wall and you watch the characters and think, this is fantastic. You know? I want the security camera tapes. I'll cut my own show. It'll blow Pawnathon away.
We're getting closer to the end here. So tell me about how this came about with recording the song and the show picked it up, and then that'll lead us into actually playing the tune for everybody.
It's just a natural extension, right? I've never done any like TV of that sense before. So as soon as I was offered the job and stuff, the first thing that came to my mind was music, because that's what we do, right? So I tried to maybe, you know, ask about who's doing the soundtrack or who's taking care, because I really didn't know what was going on at that time. And that was all taken. But just, I guess, just a natural extension, JD, because I've been a musician my whole life, and I'm not.
He was gonna get a song in there somehow, JD.
That's right.
Was determined.
That's right.
That was. And destiny. Then he calls me out of the blue, and I don't play anymore. I haven't played in 17 years, and he calls me and says, "Go on down to Charlie's house Sunday, a recording." I said, "Mark, I don't play anymore." He says, "Just go down to Charlie's on Sunday."
Charlie Forston Studios.
Charlie Lambrick, right?
Yeah.
Charlie was great.
A local.
And they did a great thing. They had it all worked out, so I just had to go in and try to figure out, you know.
Well, with the big onslaught of this Pawn stuff, you know, Nation, it's just gone crazy. Pawn Stars and Pawnathon and Storage Wars and everything. So I'm just thinking this is a natural, you know, the next obvious step.
It's the next
is
thing.
They need a Pawn man in the rock and roll world.
That's on.
So I'm going to fill that void right now, and I'm going to fill it, man.
You are filling it. It's on History Television.
History Television, and, Channel 43 in our neighborhood.
Pawnathon.com, right?
Pawnathoncanada.com.
Pawnathoncanada.com. Yeah. And tell us a little bit about the tune. What's the name of the song we're going to hear?
It's called 21st Century Pawn Man. It's self-explanatory. And
just the date of the show, when is it?
Oh, the new season is airing June 13th. We are going prime time. That's okay. Crazy.
Well, they can get all that information online as well.
Yes, you can.
And where can they find information about Tees online? Is there any place they can
Google?
All right, there you go.
The 21st Century Pawn Man website.
All right, appreciate you guys. Appreciate you being on the show.
And the future.
We're going to play the song for everybody as well. And
Big JD, it was great, man.
Hey,
you're awesome.
Thanks for being on. Really appreciate it. All right, if you weren't familiar with Tees, like I mentioned in my open, you are now. And definitely search out Tees and Tees Music on the web. And be sure to visit the 21st Century Pawn Man at PawnathonCanada.com. And more Marco, I guess, at MarkBraddock.com. And next week, Media City Film Festival program directors Jeremy Rigsby and Una Mosna join me, along with some of the film artists who will be part of the 18th annual Media City Film Festival taking place here locally in Windsor, Detroit next week. Join me then. And that's the end of today's show, and we're going to leave you with the 21st Century Pawn Man.
Shop scene, and you know I'm a crazy money lending machine, cause I'm the 21st century pawn man. My money moves fast, so fast it don't hardly last, but I'm loving the action.